So the first question about living in Atlanta. The city of Atlanta is heavily forested. It has the most tree coverage of any US city. It's in Georgia. So the nature of the city itself, it's also very hot here. Summer goes from May to the end of September. It's very humid here. We're at the foothills of the southernmost part of the Appalachian Mountains, which are not visible from the city. We're far enough away from the mountains that we cannot see them, but it affects the weather here in a certain way as regards humidity and the heat and whatnot. In terms of life in the city, the public transportation infrastructure of Atlanta was destroyed in the 1920s when General Motors bought all of the tracks that were laid for the tram, for like the streetcar. So they were bought and destroyed by General Motors, and then everyone was forced to get a car, a personal vehicle. And so, despite being in a forest, actually, Atlanta is one of the least pedestrian-friendly cities in America, and in my experience in the world, you have to drive to get anywhere. If you want to get groceries, you have to drive. If you want to go to the post office, you probably have to drive. Certainly, if you want to go anywhere else, usually there'll be just a few businesses near wherever you live, but they're usually gas stations, unless you live in a wealthy area. If you live in a very wealthy area, you have a kind of dense urban experience that you're used to thinking of in Europe or in Italy. In any case, Atlanta is also the most unequal society, or society, the most unequal city in the country in terms of economics. Where I live is a very low income area, very poor, one of the poorest in the city, and by extension, one of the poorest in the country because Georgia is one of the more impoverished states in the US. There's lots of violence here. The general nature of the wooded, forested terrain makes certain forms of control very difficult here because there's plenty of places to run away to that are off of streets if you're fleeing from the police. But otherwise, in terms of what it's like to live in the forest, I think most people are very alienated from this experience of living in the forest. As capitalist society, of course, spreads alienation of humanity from their own world and their own living terrain. Most people, I think, who are from here simply do not perceive the fact that everywhere they look, there are trees, in everyone's yard, there are trees. In all of the streets, there are trees. If you go into a building, like if you go to the city center to a building that is perhaps more than 5 or 6 stories, like if you go to like a 20-story skyscraper and you look out across the city, it actually looks like a science fiction image. It looks like you're just in a forest and there's a random building sticking up from outside of the trees. But it's hard to perceive this within the spatial landscape of the market in which we're forced to move in cars on streets from store to store. Hey, yeah. So there's two projects that we can discuss when we think about the destruction of the South River Forest and the movement to defend it. The first movement, or I'm sorry, the first project is Blackhall Studios. Blackhall Studios is a movie company. They are famous. They're owned by a man named Ryan Millsap, who is also a real estate mogul, we could say. He owns thousands of houses here in Atlanta. He's a massive landlord, and beyond renting houses, he flips them and speculates on housing, which is a shameful thing, of course, that badly damages the quality of life for people in the city as it drives up rents. But otherwise, he owns this movie company that mostly makes very bad action movies. I'm not saying action movies are bad. I'm saying the movies they make are bad. They're kind of well known for Jumanji 2, if you're familiar with that film. Anyway, what they're trying to do, they already have a sound stage in the South River Forest in a section called Constitution Lakes, which is adjacent to the parcel that is being actively defended now, which is a section that's called Entrenchment Creek, which takes its name from the creek, the water that goes through the park, which is a forest, you know, a dense forest, and not like a forest like you kind of see in parts of Italy, but with trees very close together. It's very, very much a forest, although it is in the city. I just wanted to reiterate that. And so in Entrenchment Creek, Black Hall Studios hopes to build the largest soundstage complex on Earth. Sorry, that was soundstage complex. The largest soundstage complex on Earth. And this would allow them to control climate for different episodes or movies that they're trying to film. They could simulate winter or summer, or they could simulate the desert or the mountains or something inside of a giant warehouse. And they would have an entire facility of just dozens and dozens of warehouses like this. Yeah, they're hoping to do this, which will, they argue, create thousands or even tens of thousands of jobs. And the thing about this is that where they want to build is actually next to a property that they already own, which is on Boulder Crest Road. It's in Entrenchment Creek. It's in the South River Forest, but it was a different parcel of land legally, and they clear cut that section already that they owned, just completely cut down every single tree. But because of the water drainage function that the forest provides, where runoff when there's heavy storms goes into the forest and it's kind of filtered through the forest in this area, because they cut down all the trees in the section that they already own, it floods. It floods every time it rains with lots of water. And so they don't like this. They're very unhappy about this. Of course, this is what ecologists have already been saying would happen. And so they have agreed with the city of Atlanta and the government of DeKalb County to swap, as they put it, to trade the section that they already own, which they've destroyed, for the section next to it, which currently is a public park where people can walk their dog and sit and read and what have you, which is still a forest. And so the government has actually agreed to do this, which is a really disturbing and somewhat unprecedented in at least the state of Georgia decision. Because, as is very obvious, it creates the context in which it is normal for the city government to give public infrastructure to private corporations without actually having to pass through the legislature. And so, of course, in the kind of age of austerity, we're very used to, since the 2008 crisis, we're very used to the city passing various austerity packages that close down libraries and that close down schools and that close down clinics and things of this nature, as you are also well acquainted with this pattern. But normally this passes through a legislative package. This time it's simply industry kind of steering the conversation, asking for a piece of land, and then just small bureaucrats just approving the decision at the city council level. And the idea that this could happen more and more times is obviously devastating for, well, obviously for anyone who cares about municipal democracy, which I'm not an advocate for that. I'm not concerned with that type of thing, but I am concerned with gentrification and these privatization schemes, and the way that they are related. So I do believe that the Black Hall development, aside from destroying more of the forest, which will have catastrophic effects on the amphibians who live there, and the deer who live there, and the people who live near there, also for everyone who lives in the whole metropolitan area, it will affect the flooding in the area, in the city. It will affect, which is my part of the city, you know, it will increase flooding, it will increase temperatures, but also it just creates the paradigm, the necessary legal precedent for just giving away lands to big developers. And in terms of the jobs so that it will allegedly bring, I'm not so confident that it will bring as many jobs as it will import. There's already lots of Hollywood movie companies in Atlanta and in Metro Atlanta. And they do hire lots of locals, but they prefer also to bring lots of their workers from California who are already trained in their somewhat specialized activity. In any case, they move to Georgia because the unions are weaker and the wages are lower. And so relative to the workers in California, the workers in Georgia make less money. And considered outside of just the kind of trade-based paradigm, all of this industry, all of these workers are extremely high paid compared to the rest of us. And they form something, the term kind of is disgusting sometimes, but they form something of what we could call a labor aristocracy. And often their interests are defended against the interests of the rest of the state, the rest of the workforce. I'm a food service industry worker, and so are most of my friends. And all of the new businesses and bars and apartment complexes that are being built to cater to these film industry workers, honestly, they're about five times the price as the restaurants I can go to, as the stores I can go to. Because the wages are just so high for these thousands and thousands and thousands of film industry workers. The whole situation is a bit of a frustrating paradigm to be entering into. Of course, people are interested in building solidarity with these film industry workers, but if they're kind of unable to struggle alongside us to stop efforts such as the Black Hall soundstage complex, it's hard to imagine how that could occur. The second development, the one that's most notorious, is the Cop City. So officially, the Cop City is actually slated to be named the Institute for Social Justice. And the Institute for Social Justice is, or AKA Cop City, as activists have named it, is set to be a massive police training compound that they want to build in the old Atlanta prison farm, which is in the South River Forest as well, right next to Entrenchment Creek Park, where Black Hall hopes to build their soundstage complex. And I can't stress enough that this is the same exact forest. If you actually can just move continuously through the forest between these different sections, they're intelligible as different forests only from the street, because they have different signs, but, you know, the forest doesn't care about that. It's the same forest. But for the sake of, clarity, I will refer to that section as Old Atlanta Prison Farm, where The mayor and the police hope to build this massive police training compound where they will train law enforcement from the entire region, not just from the city, but from the entire surrounding region in policing. And according to the framework that they operate within, according to the kind of liberal, progressive paradigm that they present themselves with, it will be in more progressive and less violent kind of policing, kind of soft policing or kind of soft counterinsurgency. And so for this sake, they also will be building a fake city block with a fake apartment complex where they will train raids and other kinds of peacekeeping operations, ostensibly simulating some of the areas that the city's poor black residents live in. And considering that the city is actually half black, which makes it one of the cities with the most black people in the U.S., this is quite concerning to a large number of people. The land itself, the old Atlanta prison farm, was taken from, along with the rest of the city of Atlanta, from the Muscogee Creek people in the 1820s. 1822 is when the final wave of the colonizer armies and agreements pushed the Muscogee out of this part of Georgia. And the city was formed basically as a train depot, like a train hub where different intermodal trains carrying freight from Florida and Louisiana would meet before they would go north into the industrial centers of Philadelphia and New York and Baltimore, Boston as well. And so actually Atlanta is a very new city. I maybe should have said this earlier that, 1822, the city is founded. And Georgia was a slave state. So slavery was legal here and slaves worked the land, that currently is the old Atlanta prison farm. It was owned by a slave owner named George Key. And so actually the prison farm itself is located on Key Road, which is named after this slave owner. And so the land was a plantation until the Civil War. There are many battles in the Civil War in and around Atlanta. And in the final period of the Civil War, the city was completely burned to the ground by General Sherman. He felt it was necessary to burn all the trains because they were carrying Confederate weaponry around the South. And he was on this long march to Savannah, which at the time was the state capital, which is actually a much older city than Atlanta. I think it's like 400 years old. Anyway, Sherman burned the city, and so then all of it had to be rebuilt after the American Civil War, like nearly all of the city. There's very, very few buildings, like maybe less than 20, that are older than the U.S. Civil War. And so the city began really expanding during the Reconstruction period in the 1870s and 80s, partially because it was renamed the state capital, but also because lots of money was just flooding into the city for the construction projects, for the building of the new city, the new homes, all that. And many of the recently emancipated slaves from across Georgia moved to Atlanta. Many, many of them did. And in order to kind of account for this influx of people, and people with no homes, people who had no money, people who were racialized, the city began assuming responsibility for operating public works, including a dairy works where dairy cows would be milked and milk would be bottled. And where they decided to operate their dairy works initially in the 1890s, 1880s, was at Key Road on the land that is now the old Atlanta Prison Farm. And this land operated as a dairy works for a very short period of time, only a few years, before the city decided to turn it into a prison farm, a kind of forced labor camp. This forced labor camp, I think, emerged as a kind of necessary infrastructure for the ruling class of the city, who had a vagrancy problem. There's many, many people just around the city who had no jobs, who had no homes, who, of course, were susceptible to crime and also rebellious activity, subversive activity, subversive recruiting into radical movements or gangs. And so the city began operating this land as a prison farm. They would arrest people for public drunkenness or for what have you. This was in the early 1900s. And they would just force them to do work on the land, continuing to milk cows, but also to grow crops, to grow tomatoes, to grow okra, to grow other onions, other crops that grow well in Georgia. And this lasted for many years. I'm going to send the message now since it's going on a bit long. For the decades following the construction of the prison farm, the facility expanded many times, typically under the kind of false humanitarian discourse that it was overcrowded. And of course, the way that this was imagined was that building a bigger prison was going to fix the problem of overcrowding, which is typical in the US and I think elsewhere, of a reformist carceral discourse that actually is making the carceral system bigger and bigger and bigger, because it's hard for these politicians to imagine putting less people in jail. It's just easier for them to imagine building the jail bigger. And of course, this works for the industrial forces behind the prisons who get the contracts to build them and to buy the land and all this. So in this way, the prison farm slowly expanded. There was tons of racial violence in the Jim Crow period happening on the land, as the period of Reconstruction was somewhat betrayed. The promises made to the emancipated slaves were betrayed, and the system of racial terror was more aggressively reestablished in the 20s and 30s and 40s, as is kind of described at length in the book Black Reconstruction by W.E.B. Du Bois. And in any case, the prison farm hosted lots of this violence in the city, and it continued to expand until the 80s. In the 80s, the city population began really contracting, really shrinking, as white flight and industrial like automation just drained the city of its industrial workforce. Many factories, including the General Motors factory, began closing down. Many steel factories began closing down. Lots of these factories were being moved to countries like Bangladesh and China, but also many of them in the period of the 80s and the kind of economic stagnation of the late 70s were simply closing down forever. So new job opportunities were emerging for some of the white residents of the cities in the suburbs, and the city became just very poor and very majority black. But in the context of a radically shrinking city, the surplus residents of the cities who had no homes or jobs and could be easily locked away at a prison camp, that population just began shrinking as well. And eventually, this is the context in which the prison farm is closed, as the city just loses, I think, upwards of 20% of its population in the 80s, which obviously is a tremendous drop in the population. And so now, yeah, so now on this land, they want to build this police training compound. And many people just find that incorrigible. It's just an unacceptable legacy from the colonization to slavery to prison camp to police training facility, you know, because in the decades since the closure of the prison farm, the forest has really healed. There's really wild life there now. There's deer there, other animals there, there's big trees there. It's a wetland in a way, you know, there's lots of lakes and water. And it's actually very stunning and beautiful in its own way. There's ruins of the prison farm, which are covered also in graffiti and in wild plants. For anyone who's a film of the, who's a fan of the film The Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky, there's some definite similarities between parts of the old Atlanta prison farm and the zone that the characters are walking into. And so it's just a stunning experience that many people do cherish in the city. And we just cannot allow it to turn into a police training facility. The motivation, so like, why do they want to turn this into a police training facility? Why do they need this big cop city development? It's quite simple. The George Floyd rebellion here was very ferocious, was very strong. There was rioting, looting, and attacks on police in Atlanta, just like there was in thousands of other places in the U.S., but more maybe than most of them. It certainly was not the most rebellious place in the country, but I think it was probably the top 10 most rebellious, with attacks on police infrastructure and luxury stores continuing from the end of May on again and off again from the end of May until early August. So that's quite a long time. Many places only experienced rioting for maybe 1 or 2 days. In the period of unrest, in the summer of 2020, hundreds of police officers quit their jobs. We know that at least 200 officers with the Atlanta Police Department quit their jobs. I don't have the numbers, nor have I ever seen the statistics on how many officers in the sheriff's department for the county quit, or for the public transit police, or the FBI, or the Georgia State Patrol, who patrol the interstate highways. I do not know how many of them quit, but definitely some, and I think maybe a lot. And so in the period since the end of 2020, there's just really less police in the city, like really noticeably less police. And the morale for the police is extremely low. They feel constantly attacked. They feel mistrusted and hated, which they are. Also, a part of this story is that in June of 2020, in the heat of the George Floyd Rebellion, here in my neighborhood, a man named Rayshard Brooks was killed by the police in the parking lot of a Wendy's, which is like a fast food restaurant. He was taking a nap in his car, and the police harassed him, and they ended up taking his life. In the days that followed, the neighborhood rose up. People burned down the Wendy's, which had called the police on Rayshard Brooks, and clashed with police, attacked the local police station repeatedly, and began looting stores and all of this. And what was shocking was that immediately the officers who killed Rayshard Brooks were charged with murder and arrested, which, as I'm sure is well known to your listeners in Italy and in Europe, this almost never happens in the U.S. I still doubt that the officers will be convicted of murder and go to prison, but even charging them with murder is actually rare. And so the fact that these officers were charged with murder after what was already weeks and weeks of riots and clashes with the police was just deeply upsetting to the entire city's police force. And they initiated what is sometimes called a blue flu, right? Where they all kind of went on an informal strike. I'm gonna send the message and I'll continue. So this blue flu is basically all of the cops call in and they say that they're sick. And in my neighborhood, actually almost all of the cops said that they were sick. And so this is, of course, a glorious time for people. You could walk into the police station and you would see that there's no cops. In any case, I won't belabor this point too much. There's plenty of things you can read about online in regards to the summer of 2020. But the point is that the city of Atlanta faces an immense bureaucratic crisis where they're trying to gentrify the city as fast as possible, which is actually working. It's one of the most rapidly gentrifying cities in America. They're trying to gentrify it as fast as possible, but they need the police in order to do this, because obviously unequal societies require violence to maintain, and the more unequal the society, the more violence that's required to maintain it. Although the city does a great job using kind of various ideological strategies to govern the territory, including maintaining a narrative of black progress. And, the mayor of the city has been black for 50 years. The chief of police is generally black. Most of the low-level bureaucrats are black, and then most of the police officers are black, which is very rare in the U.S. Only 13% of the U.S. is black, although half of Atlanta is black, as I mentioned earlier. But even in cities where mostly the city is black, it's so rare that the entire political bureaucracy is black. This, of course, does not at all mean that there's no racism in Atlanta, not even close. All of the big industrial powers, all the big capitalists are a part of the kind of white supremacist power structure. But together, they operate a kind of strange clientele structure, informally known as the Atlanta Way, in which the black political class and the black bureaucracy works with the white capitalists to kind of prevent racial justice movements or like protest movements against racism from even emerging by engaging in literally behind closed doors conversations where various agreements are made, like various investment strategies are kind of steered in part by the conversations of this kind of the like black elites in order to win some kind of benefits for the black people who live in the city. And so that is true, but not nearly enough, and certainly not enough to keep pace with the displacement that is now occurring because of gentrification. And so, yes, all the politicians are black and many of the cops are black, but also the poorest people are black. The poorest neighborhoods are the black neighborhoods. And this kind of a clientele system does not really at all address this. It just creates a tremendous political racket that prevents people from adequately understanding their circumstances. But it's really starting to break apart, as the revolt in 2020 makes clear. And so because it's breaking apart, there's also, concerns among the white ruling class in the city, and also the just wealthy white people who live in the north part of the city, of crime. And their concern with crime is partially manufactured by the five or six, media companies that own all of the local news, stations in America. So I'm not talking about the national news companies, but just the local news companies. Sinclair Media Group in particular, which is owned by kind of right-wing individuals who are close friends with Donald Trump. They've been pushing now for 2 years that all over the country a narrative about a crime wave. So every single city you go to in the whole U.S., even small towns, they all have this narrative that the city is experiencing a crime wave, and that urban liberals have defunded the police and that's why there's a crime wave, which all that is not true. But what's important to understand is that the way that media is consumed in the US, as I'm sure it is in Europe, is very uneven. And older people very much watch local news more or less all day, or at least that's where they get their news. And young people know, so it's like a big contradiction. But these older people who watch the news, some of them are influenced by this fake narrative about the crime wave, and they now want the police academy to exist. They want the cop city to exist. Or at least some of them do. They at least want more police. They want more safety. And it's understandable to want more safety, of course. But the city isn't actually more dangerous. But the landlords think it's more dangerous, you know. The small business owners think it's more dangerous. And in some regards, I think there has been more burglary of some of these stores as the coronavirus crisis continues to really badly hurt employment for working class people. And as many businesses have closed down. In any case, this contradiction between maintaining social peace for gentrification and also maintaining the veneer, the kind of appearance of progressivism is what has led the city to kind of develop this plan for the so-called Institute for Social Justice, because they hope to be able to build a tremendous police training compound in the middle of the forest, which would be a great gift to the police. But they also want to call it the Institute for Social Justice because they want to seem like they are actually trying to help mitigate police violence. So they want to do both things at the same time, which is just an absolute farce. They definitely, I don't think, can do both anymore, although they've done both quite successfully for decades with episodes of resistance being quite sporadic. But that period is behind us now, I think. The Cop City development in particular, and shortly after the Black Hall development, were discovered by activists in the spring of last year before they were publicly announced. And these projects were they were happening in kind of semi-public, semi-secretive meetings. Like technically they were public, but there was no announcement about them. So you could only find out about them if you were very obsessive and just constantly surveilling the city government, which luckily some people are. And so in the spring of last year, some activists called together a meeting with, it was anarchists and local environmentalists and anti-police organizers, abolitionists, some socialist groups. And there was a big assembly where all the information was shared. And hundreds of people were there. It was a great event. And everyone there kind of dedicated themselves to beginning to mobilize their communities and their organizations against the project. Not even a week later, actually, several excavators and pieces of heavy machinery were burned in the forest. And there was an online claim of responsibility published directly connecting the attack to the developments in the forest. That was actually just the opening of the movement. That's how it all began. And in the period since then, since last spring, since a year ago, this kind of action has been a constant feature of the movement, where there's big public events, and there's community support, and there's concerts, and there's people knocking on doors, talking to neighbors, and there's some protest actions, and there's concerts, and there's sabotage. And the sabotage is not actually the most important feature of the movement in terms of what people think about and work toward, but it is a respected part of the movement that I think people think has a legitimate place inside of the movement. And so that's kind of a new development in U.S. struggles, or at least a development that has not been, that's a dynamic that's not been present in U.S. struggles for decades, I think. Speaking in terms of Black Lives Matter and the role of Black Lives Matter in the movement, this I think will be kind of it takes some explaining to do, just because Black Lives Matter is a national organization in the U.S. led by some former college students. And I don't know where they live or what their names are. But it's also just a slogan that millions of people have embraced. So including in Italy, including in Nigeria, including in other parts of the world. And so the organization Black Lives Matter, they don't really exist here, or if they do, I don't know that they exist or what they do. In the past, they had more of an influence steering protest movements, for better and for worse. But I can say definitively that the 2020 George Floyd protests were not really influenced by any of their members or cadre. But it is the framework, though, of Black liberation, of Black struggles in general, issues surrounding Black people affect every real struggle in the U.S. Is absolutely the case that this forms a kind of central contradiction within the American capitalist system, and almost every political issue can easily be understood through the grammar of Black liberation and of anti-Black violence. And so obviously, because this land was a former slave site, and because the police are chiefly, not maybe chiefly, or are largely a kind of instrument for controlling the kind of young Black people. In many instances, or at least they control everyone, but at least the instance of most gratuitous violence that we're used to seeing is levied against Black people in the cities. And because gentrification also is primarily displacing poor Black people, while also the political representation of progress is Black in this city, you know, it's just very connected to the entire wave of movements that have taken place in the past 7-8 years here in the U.S. and in Atlanta as well. As for the role of the indigenous people in the movement, it's kind of difficult because the Muscogee people, who lived here for thousands of years before European colonization, were mostly removed forcibly from the state by former U.S. President Andrew Jackson in an event that's known as the Trail of Tears, where many thousands of people were forced to march very long distances across the terrain, away from their homes, for the sake of urbanization and American conquest. And so many Muscogee people live in Oklahoma, not here in Georgia, not here in Atlanta. Although there are indigenous organizers here, and there have been what they call rematriation efforts. So efforts to bring Muscogee people here to participate in the movement. Not long ago, a tribal committee from Oklahoma actually came. This was in last fall, came to do a stomp dance ceremony in the South River Forest. And this was an incredible event. You know, they spoke the Creek language, which actually very few people can understand. I think less than 10 children can speak Creek. Two of them came to the forest. And they had their ceremony, and they answered questions, and they gave some beautiful speeches. But this wasn't just a kind of simple cultural sharing moment in a kind of liberal way. For the Muscogee, they were determined to let us know that the Muscogee people will continue to live on this continent for another 10,000 years, and that they want everyone to help defend Wilani, which is the word that they call the South River Forest, so to defend this forest from the Cop City development, from Black Hall Studios. So that was a tremendous moment, actually, for people in the movement. And I think also for the Muscogee people who see themselves in the movement, but also with a kind of deeper connection to the land, or at least who are beginning to kind of rekindle that connection somehow. That was a very cool event. In terms of media coverage, it's actually quite interesting. Cox Enterprises is a media company. Cox Media, they own the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is the biggest media outlet in the city and in the state of Georgia. And Alex Taylor, who is the president of Cox, he is actually on a board that helps to kind of oversee public safety with the Atlanta Police Foundation. And so there's a major conflict of interest between the biggest media company here and the protest movement. And it's well known. And of course, in order to maintain journalistic integrity, they're supposed to always disclaim that, okay, yes, we're covering this protest, maybe, or we're covering this development, but we have to let you know that our company is also connected to it. In a way, this has made them actually shy to even talk about the development, and other news outlets have covered it a little more. And I think that's really interesting. By and large, I think the media coverage has actually not been so bad. I think partially because people in the Defend the Forest, Stop Cop City movement are actually just more media savvy than our adversaries. Overall have a better understanding of writing, of operating social media, of making press releases, of talking to journalists, and also are just more exciting and intelligent people in general who have a more compelling narrative, who have better justifications, have a more interesting way of speaking and thinking than the police do, who just don't really have a lot going for them in terms of crafting narrative. They only really have a kind of fear-based monologue. And so I think the coverage hasn't been so bad, but in terms of finding out about new developments, that just takes research. It takes the help of lawyers who are involved in the movement to request documentation. It takes journalists who are involved in the movement, like kind of doing deep dives, like trying to find out what they can. And, you know, as you can imagine, a lot of the information is not so easy to come by. But at just an early stage, I think a lot of research was done. People seemed to learn a lot really right away. And because there's lots of intelligent and cunning people involved in the movement, people are constantly learning new things. As well, there's people living in the forest who have a kind of occupation there, with tree houses included. And they have they also do their own research. You know, they're able to see things that happen. They're able to identify trucks and workers' uniforms and whatnot. So information also comes in from on the ground, from activists actively putting their bodies on the line to defend the forest, to stop the construction. So that is another way. So going back to the question of sabotage and of the kind of direct targeting of individuals, I'll just say that, like, it's not normal in protest movements in the US for so many people to accept direct action or sabotage. I think after the George Floyd protests, and even after the period of kind of militant anti-fascism during the Trump presidency, I think many more people feel like there is some contexts in which some level of vandalism or kind of more combative methods are legitimate. But also I think it's connected in some part to a kind of liberal diversity paradigm, as odd as that sounds. Like, the fact that people who do nocturnal acts of sabotage are not really endangering anyone else when they do this, right? They're not risking other people getting arrested, you could say, or that's probably how some people would frame it. This makes people kind of don't care. They're like, okay, well, some people decided to go burn a tractor. Well, but that, you know, I wasn't there. It doesn't affect me. So good for them. Sounds pretty cool, and I have no real thoughts about it. This is a bit different from a more mass direct action paradigm in which, for instance, during a protest in a crowd, some determined and organized and or intelligent people maybe break windows or throw things at the police. The feeling is, could result in more people facing repression, right? And the police charging the crowd and beating people or arresting people. And so people are in general often more concerned about that kind of action than they are about arson or sabotage. And so I'm hesitant to say that the direct action component of the movement is like growing in its support. I'm more just cautious about that because I think that concerns about political violence in the U.S. actually are not about violence. I actually do not think that many people in the U.S. care about nonviolence. I think it more just has to do with a feeling of getting in trouble for something someone else did, of being endangered by someone else's decisions. So people don't take collective responsibility for movements, and they want just to kind of be an individual in the movement. And that's something that's tough to kind of grapple with. There's a lot of contradictions in that. In any case, you mentioned also the home demonstrations. There's a tendency in the movement. It's growing. It's becoming the kind of a major way forward, I think, for the movement to identify individuals who are directly responsible for the projects. For instance, people who own companies that are going to clear the land to cut down trees or do things like this, and to find the home address of the CEO of the company, and then to go to their house and ask them to stop the project, to drop out of the project, which in the United States, this is actually completely legal. You're just allowed to do this, to publish the information online, where they live and what their phone number is and what they look like, because there's freedom of speech and all of this. And so I think this is like a not violent activity that allows people to use direct action without doing a crime. And so I think that this will continue to develop as a strategy in the movement, for people to publish, for instance, on websites like StopReevesYoung.com. Reeves Young is the major construction company that will be working on the Cop City. It seems like activists have found out a lot of information about the owner of the company, the owners of the company, and where they live. Also, the companies that company works with. So people are seemingly beginning to pressure or ask the subcontractors of the construction company to drop out of all of their projects with Reeves Young, with the construction company. I think the idea there is that any company who has an economic connection to Reeves Young, the construction company for the Cop City, but does not have a financial connection to the Atlanta Police Foundation, who is contracting Reeves Young, that company should be asked to divest from the project, right? Because they have lots of other contracts. Economically, they do not need the Cop City or Reeves Young, but Reeves Young does need them. And of course, the Atlanta Police Foundation doesn't build anything. They need Reeves Young. They need a construction company. And so I think this is just the idea, is just to slowly isolate the service provider, the construction company, you know, from their other contracts, to bring them to the point where they have to calculate, just rationally, they'll have to calculate at some point whether or not they want to continue to be a construction company or if they want to finish the Cop City. So we're hoping that we're able to help them reach a situation where they're able to decide that they do not want to build the Cop City development. And if we can accomplish that by simply going to some people's houses and knocking on their doors and letting them know what's happening, what we think, what we want them to do, you're actually allowed to do that in the United States. That's not, you know, I'm talking nonviolently, of course. You're just going and having a conversation with them. There's nothing wrong with that. Sorry, I know I'm going so long now, but yeah, there's an occupation in Entrenchment Creek Park and in the old Atlanta prison farm, like in the South River Forest. There's people living, people camping, people establishing kitchens and tree houses and other structures in the forest. I think some of these people are veterans of similar movements in other countries, including in Canada, but also in France at the Notre Dame de Landes, also in the Hambach Forest in Germany. Beyond that, definitely people are influenced by those movements, also by similar anti-infrastructural struggles in Latin America and in the U.S. in general, which actually has a robust history of anti-infrastructural movements. Most famously, the Standing Rock, the movement in Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline. So I think people are aware of these other movements, are inspired by them. I think that during an upcoming week of action from May 7th to May 12th, I think that there will be more people staying in the forest. The city hopes to begin clearing the encampment at the end of May in order to proceed with their next phase of construction. And I have a sense that the defensive wing of the movement, which is in the forest, will become very important at that time, sometime in the middle or the beginning of the summer. Yeah, so it's hard to divide movements into phases. This is kind of a mythological operation to do to historical events, but it can be helpful, as myths can often be helpful, just for us to understand the ebbs and flows of power, the balance of forces between the movement and the adversaries of the movement, in the police and in the city and in the companies. You know, there is lots of internal conversation in the movement. There's meetings, there's assemblies, there's different online platforms, and you know, sometimes people meet and they're able to reflect on what's happening. And I think one thing that the movement has is really the initiative. People in the movement are very, very cunning and very willing to change methods and approaches, just to keep the initiative on the development, to always be ahead of the plans of our adversaries. And so because of this fluid mentality, this kind of pluristrategic mentality, this has allowed people to move from a phase of information gathering and awareness to sabotage, to protesting against the city council to try to like legally stop the development, to a phase of kind of directly blockading the forest and like trying to stop construction workers, to what I think is going to be the next approach, which is both offensive and defensive. So building the occupation in the forest, increasing the defensive capacity of the movement, and then also increasing the pressure against subcontractors going to the homes of the bosses, as I mentioned. And so, like, I think a lot of people in the movement have this general consciousness that this is what is happening. And it's been a feature since the very beginning of the movement that people want the movement to be diverse. They want people with different angles, different strategies to participate and to feel welcome in the movement, different organizing groups to feel welcome in the movement, and not just to feel welcome and like they have to work together, but to think about other people's strategies, and even if you will not participate in it, to develop your strategy according to the strengths and weaknesses of other strategies. Even if you do not like the people doing it, even if you do not know them, just so that the movement as a whole remains healthy and robust. Yeah, so finally, in May, there's going to be a National Day of Action on the 1st of May against Atlas Consultants, which is a company that is contracted with Reeves Young. Reeves Young is the company, once again, that is supposed to build the Cop City. And as a part of this, they have a number of consulting companies, a number of surveyors who observe the land and who measure soil composition and treat tree width and all kinds of things like this. And Atlas Consulting has offices all over the country in 40 different U.S. states. And so there's a National Day of Action to pressure them. I'm sure there will also be local targets that people protest against or contact. Otherwise, you know, there's lots of financiers for the APF project, for the Atlanta Police Foundation project, the Cop City. Those are all available online, but like they include, for instance, the Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you know, Coca-Cola, all the companies that are connected to them, Delta Airlines. I think that organizers here are hoping that people take up this struggle and contribute to it in the ways that they're able from where they live. So either coming to the forest or doing actions where they live against the people who are propping up this project. So far, there actually have been solidarity actions in other places. A consulting company in Minneapolis last year who is working with the construction of the Cop City, they actually had their windows smashed out. There was a statement online about that, talking about the Cop City and defend the forest. There are some actions in in Philadelphia. Wells Fargo Bank had some ATMs destroyed by anarchists who were, according to their online statement, acting in solidarity with Defend the Forest and the Stop Cop City. It's kind of an interesting moment where movements of that nature, actions of that nature, have not happened so much in the U.S. in a few years, maybe half a decade, as other kind of struggles and other forms of struggle have become more popular. I assume there will be more actions like that in the future, but I think many people are focusing on trying to make sure that there's also a mass character to the movement, with lots of participation from small children and more senior people, and to make sure that both of those things can occur at the same time within the movement. I think that's really an important thing for people to maintain the ecology of forces as we try to also defend the ecology of the land.